It's The Wonky Show. We're back for another academic year, looking at the year ahead, all the shenanigans around international students and immigration, and a review of university governance is on. But is it going to make any difference? It's all coming up.
We know that the teaching unit of resource doesn't cover the full economic cost. So you put two and two together, and what seems to be happening is that these institutions are trying to, you know, at the very least cover some of their variable costs by bringing in more students through clearing. But that is not a sustainable strategy.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to get across this week's developments, as usual, three brilliant guests. In Glasgow, Anton Moscatelli is just about still principal at the University of Glasgow. Anton, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, my highlight of the week is the latest debate around student visas, asylum, and of course, we're waiting for what happens in terms of this year's recruitment.
Yes. Nervous time around the sector. In Buckinghamshire, Danny Payne is Head of Education and Social Mobility at the Social Market Foundation. Danny, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is actually getting some rain to help with the garden, which is being very productive at the moment. Lots of courgettes, lots of tomatoes.
It wasn't my highlight walking through Luton this morning. And in his Liverpool home, James Coe is Associate Editor here at Wonky. Jimbo, your highlight of the week, please.
Highlight of the week, we went on a scavenger hunt, me and baby Olive. And Jim, you will not believe this, we found absolutely everything except one singular squirrel and a mushroom. But need a full house on the household scavenger hunt this week.
Extraordinary. So, yes, we start this week with the year ahead. Jimbo, you've been keeping tabs on the tea leaves. What should we be braced for?
I feel like I should start off by saying welcome back. It's a new series, it's a new beginning, and it's the start of the new term. Summer's behind us, weather looks terrible, you know, the usual welcome back to school feeling. And whilst it might feel like a new year, some things don't change, do they, Jim? The financial situation, the government looks as bleak as ever. Productivity is stuck. Every time I open the newspaper, it seems there's more bad news for Rachel Reeves. And caught in the midst of all of this is, of course, the future of our sector. And I think in the year ahead, we're going to see some big things. We're expecting a skills white paper to emerge, probably the increase in tuition fees that will come with it. But let's see what the news is. We have the small issue of an international student fee levy to sort out. We'll see what comes of that. And of course, outside of teaching and learning, we've got a whole space of things in research. What does the future of REF look like? How's R&D spending going to be finally hypothecated? In what ways? And what is the entire ecosystem going to look like a year from now? I think this is probably the year where something is finally either going to have to be sorted out or something will give.
Well, there you go. Probably not a lot of giving. Danny, let's start with this international student levy that was, of course, you know, floated in the immigration white paper. You know, what are your thoughts? I mean, my sense is that if you're the Department for Education, you haven't really got a lot of money to sort of squirt in particular directions these days. And so this is an attempt to at least influence at least something.
Yes, I think it's a difficult one. And I think when the levy was first floated in the immigration white paper, there was a feeling that it would kind of fade out of existence, that it seemed to be something that was pulled together very quickly in an agreement between Treasury, Home Office, DfE, to have something to put in the white paper. But it then was repeated in the industrial strategy and so on. So it does seem like this is something that DfE are considering and wanting to move ahead with. The question is, of course, how would it actually work? Would it actually work? It only works taking a kind of a portion of international student fees if those students still continue to come and can pay that price. I think the original intention was that DfE felt that universities would be able to raise fees in response, and that cost would then fall on the international student. Of course, that's extremely difficult for the types of providers that are not recruiting, you know, extremely rich international students and international students for whom are struggling to afford the fees and the living costs as they currently are. I guess the worst case scenario is that, you know, international students can't pick up that additional cost and that hits the providers who are struggling the most already. Often lower tariff providers who have been trying to expand their international student market, whilst the high tariff providers scoop up a huge share of the undergraduate home market.
Yeah, I mean, that's particularly interesting. That we'll get to that. And Anton, there's obviously not just the levy. There's the increase of these three targets, isn't there? The BCA compliance targets. Just explain what's going on there, because that's a bit. It's slightly less above the surface, I guess.
Yeah, it's probably less in the press, in the mainstream press, but essentially, you know, the Home Office is trying to make sure that the system is not being abused, and therefore you're looking at indicators like how many visas are being refused to incentivize universities to offer to genuine candidates. It's looking at the extent to which students complete, and that's actually a good thing. And so, you know, these indicators will absolutely matter. Now, again, as Danny says, this will affect the sector differentially. If you look at, you know, Russell Group University, like my own, you know, our indicators are well within the boundaries that have been set by the Home Office. So it's less concerning. But in a number of providers, other providers, you know, these will become real issues. And we'll begin to see some of that playing out with providers having to put in action plans, you know, for UKVI, etc.
Jimbo, just as a little cul-de-sac here, one of the things I've done this week is look at the consumer protection law implications of deposits, right? And it does strike me that as institutions use, you know, relatively high, actually, tuition fee deposits to make sure that they comply with those targets, you know, that's not necessarily compatible with notions of student choice and actually, you know, depending on how you read consumer protection law, what the law says about, you know, locking people in.
Well, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I took from your blog is effectively you are only allowed to recover costs up until your actual costs, not a sort of hypothecated one. So I think the extent to which you can sort of protect your losses in that kind of way is highly questionable. But if I can just make a wider point about this, I think the whole debate, and I realize I'm going to talk about economics on a podcast with an economist, but it is a fundamental misunderstanding of how the UK's economy works. We're not really brilliant at lots of things, and higher education is one of the few ones, but we've decided on this completely bizarre path to try and make it as least appealing as possible by dampening demand. It seems to make absolutely no sense, whether it's the levy, whether it's the changes to the postgraduate visa, whether it is the sort of wider regulation point. I don't really see what this is going to achieve for anybody other than some short-term headline benefits about crackdown immigration, etc., etc. But the whole thing just strikes me as completely bizarre and a waste of political energy when the government doesn't have much.
Yes. Danny, let's swing back to this demand issue. So, you know, if I'm looking at this morning's UCAS clearing stats, we've got this fascinating, you know, over 10 years decline in admissions, undergraduate admissions, obviously this is undergraduate admissions to lower tariff institutions, and a really sharp increase, particularly over the past couple of years, actually, to high tariff institutions. What's going on here? What are the implications here?
I think it depends what group of people you're interested in kind of understanding the implications on. So for a lot of students, you know, they on their A-level results day this year or whichever qualification route they followed had perhaps more happier news than they would have expected. Even if they didn't meet their grades, we were seeing more and more students getting into their first choice university and many also going through clearing and then being able to access a higher tariff or a more selective course or university than they had originally thought that they would be capable of getting into. Now, you can see this as a positive for social mobility in some ways. We know that high tariff institutions come with particular earning benefits for students later in life, that they might also have greater resources in institutions. And so you can see it in a positive in that way, that it's giving opportunities to students who are statistically likely to come from, more likely to come from disadvantaged backgrounds and to have faced disruption in their learning and being given almost a second chance into kind of a high tariff selective institution. But I think it's also important to think about the motivation of the universities and why they are suddenly taking in, you know, far more students on lower grades than before. This is not necessarily a deliberate contextual admissions widening access social mobility strategy. It does seem to be quite financially motivated in terms of that universities are trying to plug budget gaps by getting in as many students as they can. We saw some of the consequences of this during COVID, where loads of students got higher than predicted grades and universities were not able to predict that and had much larger class sizes, and there was pressures on accommodation and pressures on resource within universities. And that has obviously led to, you know, a sizable minority of students who were unhappy with that experience that they received, who felt that there wasn't enough staff staff to support them. And I think there's a serious question around how much a university should be allowed to grow each year based on realistically, how many more staff can they recruit year on year? How many buildings can they acquire or build? Do they have enough lecture space? You know, is it responsible that we have a market that basically is completely uncapped in the amount an institution can grow each year, and that that growth is motivated not necessarily only by the provision they can provide to students or their quality, but more by financial pressures in which they feel that their only option is to take in more students to get in more tuition fees?
Yes, Anton, I mean, you know, I'm not asking you to speak for the, you know, for the whole of the higher tariff portion of the sector, but, you know, there is a sense, I think, that there's a danger that in higher tariff universities, people have been, you know, recruiting to a financial target and then, you know, effectively intending to deliver some shrinkflation in the student experience. Is that fair?
I think that's a danger, and absolutely, Danny's right in pointing out that you know, this is on this underlying behavior, and it's probably a reaction to the shrinking of the international markets for some universities. And I think what worries me most actually is the sustainability of this, because we know that the teaching unit of resource, whether you're in England through the fee system or in Scotland with publicly funded higher education, it doesn't cover the full economic costs. So you put two and two together, and what seems to be happening is that these institutions are trying to, you know, at the very least cover some of their marginal costs, some of their variable costs by bringing in more students through clearing. But that is not a sustainable strategy, because you will still be running. You're adding to your deficit potentially. So actually, I mean, that worries me deeply. And you know, just to finish on one thing, I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion around the future of funding and a white paper and what reviews might eventually happen both in England and Scotland and elsewhere in the UK. But I do think you need to start. I think Danny's right. You need to start with the shape of the sector. What is the right shape of the sector? And funding is really the final piece of the puzzle for me. It's not where you start. And I'm afraid, you know, funding competition is leading us in this direction.
Yeah, Jimbo, down at the, in lower tariff institutions, there's, obviously there's been a kind of corresponding significant decline. What, do you have a sense of, you know, what that's kind of sort of doing on the ground? You know, are we just looking at, you know, endless reorganizations and voluntary redundancy rounds and so on, or are we getting closer to that sort of almost apocryphal, you know, institutional collapse?
Well, look, if something doesn't happen, there's suddenly a huge uptake in students, some new operating models emerge, or the government comes up with some cash, some institutions are likely to collapse. They will simper and out of money. The thing that concerns me, as well as, of course, the experience for all the people who work there, is clearly this is, going back to Anton and Dan's point, not an ideal way to design a higher education sector, where effectively what you say is we have a collective obligation to train the labour force of the future, that were really good for our places. You might have seen the Centre for Cities report that came out yesterday that talks about, you know, the work that universities do to stimulate high streets. Effectively, that entire thing will just fall apart, which would be a disaster in all kinds of ways. So that worries me. I suppose the thing that I'm yet to see, and I know talk is going on, is the transformations that are being promised of, we're going to do some big mergers, we're going to find completely new ways of working, etc. Maybe they will come, but I think they're probably quite hard to do.
But I mean, let me ask you this question, Jimbo, right? So obviously, on one level, the government is interested in, you know, economic growth and regions and you know, all, you know, whatever this government is calling levelling up and so on. And then on the other hand, you know, all the indications are that it daren't interfere with the notion of student choice. Now, you know, will it? It clearly hasn't got a lot of money to do incentives to put on provision in certain places or to encourage students to go to certain places. So what has it got left other than, you know, some type of student number distribution?
Well, I mean, James, the problem is you can't have it both ways. You can't on the one hand say that universities are the economic ballast through which the country's future will be secured, and then at the same time say we're going to do everything we can, intentionally or unintentionally, to minimise the units of resource they have in order to distribute that funding and do good stuff. I think there's only a few ways forward, right? So either you have to come up with a new model of managing student demand and moving away somewhat from an entirely student demand-led system. That would be a huge change to do that kind of planning. But there is something a bit odd in saying that there is no sort of central government commissioning of higher education. You know, there is potentially something there. The second is that you continue to squeeze up the unit of resource and hope things get a little bit better on the home student front and enough to stabilise the sector. Or third, you try and expand the incentives that universities are working towards to support economic growth in doing things like redistributing research funding based on regional latent capacity, looking at things like linking up city regions and skills. But there isn't really loads of tools other than change how demand works, increase unit pricing, or move the incentives in order to encourage growth. It's sort of the only tools government has, particularly when they're saying we've got a 29 million black hole to fill or whatever it is at the moment.
Yeah, that huge black hole. Well, look, I mean, we are fatally, of course, recording this ahead of ministerial speeches at Universities UK. So, you know, all of this might be complete nonsense by the time this goes out. But Anton, we've heard hints, haven't we, of changes coming to the ref. What's your sense of what might be coming?
Well, I think my sense, Jim, is that Ian Chapman has probably come in to his new role as chief executive of UKRI and is worried about some of the noise in the sector and the potential for the new, you know, the new elements of Ref 2029 to be some ultra bureaucratic, and that they are going to call for a short pause to make sure that everything's aligned and everything's ready. I think they really desperately do want to continue, as does the sector, with Ref in 2029. But I think they will spend a bit of time trying to see if everything's, you know, right in that space, and perhaps see whether some of the additional tassels that have been put in, particularly under people, culture, and the environment, can be stripped out.
No, Anton, I'd be interested in your take that, like, we've spent an awful, I mean, Danny as well, obviously, we've spent an awful lot of energy discussing REF and its future and, like, its links, but as a proportion of the overall amount of research funding and the size that the country faces, it seems like the debate has just sucked so much energy away from, like, what kind of research system do we want, how should it be funded, how do you distribute, how does it work growth? It has become this enormous time sort of warp. We can't escape.
I agree, Jimbo. But on the other hand, I mean, having been part of the Stern Review back in, you know, in the previous REF, I strongly believe that we got the balance there about right. And that, and look, I agree, we shouldn't overcomplicate it, but not having a REF, and the candidate, not having a REF is actually dangerous for the sector because there's an accountability issue about the QR that's distributed. So I think keeping to those rules would have been much, much better instead of trying to build this edifice that clearly UKRI have been building on it.
So, I mean, I'll frame it. I think there's probably three things from what we've seen so far. Clearly, everything is moving towards trying to tie research funding closer to the government's missions, and the UKRI missions leads are due to come into post. So if there was a serious attempt to more clearly align what UKRI is doing and the other research funders with government, I think that's probably a sensible thing. I'm concerned, I suppose, over the next few years of a potential decline in capital investment. And we've seen that in some of the funding calls that have come out. And it's the type of infrastructure that universities build that's ultimately good for economies, lab spaces, sort of, you know, digital soft infrastructure. And I suppose the third is there's not going to be a huge injection of cash. And I suppose the thing that we saw in the last UKRI settlement was a flat cash settlement. If that continues for too long, of course, that erodes the spending power generally. So I don't think there'll be new money. I think the money for missions and a bit of stuff around defence and health. And then we've got the whole discussion around Horizon industrial strategy alignment still to come.
And I agree with all of that. And I think we've got to be very careful to make sure that the additional mechanisms around mission-led research is well designed. The other area I worry about is PhD training in this country, because high level skills are important to the industrial strategy. Then, you know, most of PhDs don't stay within the sector, they go into industry. And a lot of this tightening of funding could end up falling on less PhD training. And that would actually be a really, really bad thing for the country.
Well, this just in, let's hear a clip of Patrick Vallance at UUK conference.
I've agreed with the devolved administrations and with Ian Chapman, the new chief executive of UKRI, that we should pause where we are at the moment, take 3 months to make sure that we have this properly aligned to what we're trying to achieve, not to delay the overall timelines. It will continue to be in 2029 as planned, but we must make sure that we get it right. We must make sure that it does measure the things that we know we want it to measure, and it doesn't get bound down by measuring things that don't actually impact on what we're trying to understand.
But look, it's not very long, and I assume that on the back of this, there's going to have to be an enormous amount of bringing the sector back on side, what feels quite fractious. I think if they delay the exercise beyond 2029, it could be fatal to its success because of how long it'd be since the previous one. So 3 months on the one hand feels like no time at all, but I think it's probably about as far as they could push it. I'm pleased they paused. I'm not sure it's going to make anybody happy unless they do something distinctive with the measurements one way or the other, or come back and say, no, we're absolutely sticking to it. But it just feels like more uncertainty, albeit maybe necessary uncertainty.
Yes. Now, before Before we move on, I'm going to give you, all three of you, an opportunity just to pick one thing that perhaps isn't big in the news that, you know, might be floating around that people ought to think about. Maybe a prediction. Who knows?
Oh, I'm happy to go first. I think that something which has gone under the radar is the extent, is what government might want universities to do on teaching quality and student outcomes. So obviously, that was one of Bridget Phillipson's big asks for the sector when she increased tuition fees in line with inflation, particularly if we're expecting that to potentially be linked to inflation long term. We would then be expecting there to be more asks coming from government and more something more specific on what they want universities to do on teaching quality. I think there's a possibility that the Office for Students starts to regulate based on the extent to which universities equip graduates with valuable labour market skills, especially in light of the growing concerns about, you know, declining grad jobs and AI, and also doubts on the data behind the graduate premium. And there was a report that the Institute for Fiscal Studies produced in May that I thought went under the radar that was looking at the feasibility of the Office for Students using graduate earnings data to actually regulate universities. And they recommended that it should be added to the OFS framework to complement existing B3 progression metrics. And it's my understanding that the DfE asked IFS to look into this. The DfE was on the advisory board. So that may well be coming up this year too, especially given the article in the Times this morning about potentially capping university fees based on teaching quality using the TEF.
Very interesting. Anton?
Well, I'm going to choose something left field because obviously we've talked about quite a lot this morning. But one of the things the government is going to have to try and do over the next year is pull out all the stops on economic growth. One element of what they're doing here is, of course, the discussions with the EU around, you know, deepening the trade and cooperation agreement. And of course, we've talked on and off over the last year about the youth mobility scheme and what might be, you know, an alternative to it, given that the UK wasn't enamored with the Commission's initial draft. But that's an area I think that could make a comeback. And look, I'm as you know, I've been profoundly anti-Brexit, and I have argued that this has been, you know, the loss of talent to the UK has been a huge drag potentially on our growth. So I do hope that that will perhaps see an opportunity for us to have talented young people come to the UK and contribute to from Europe and actually contribute to our growth trajectory. So watch out for something like the Youth Mobility Scheme.
Yes, and I see they've at least tendered for someone to run Erasmus Plus. So fingers crossed, folks. Fingers crossed, Jimbo.
That's a problem with left field predictions, Jim. They're really hard or nonsense. So let me give you a quick one. I think we are going to see international security issues bubble up once again. And I think it'll happen for a couple of reasons. Horizon conversations are ongoing, and the framing of Europe as a, inverted commas, safe partner. And the report which came out from the, I can't remember what committee it was, looking at the UK's relationship with Iran, saying that there had been legitimate evidence of spying. And the report which came out from British Council saying that 24% of all research collaborations with AI were carried out with China. It seems to me, alongside the FIRS Act, there's going to be a little bit of period of what is the UK doing in the world, and our universities exposing us to undue risks once again. I feel like that's in the waters.
And just before we get to who's been blogging for us this week, I'll give you mine, which is, in a year when all of the student finance arrangements have gone up by an OBR projection of inflation, which looks like it was undercooked because inflation's currently running significantly higher than that, depending on which devolved nation you're talking about or Westminster. And in a period where food inflation is significantly higher than average inflation, and in a year when it looks to me like we may well in several cities be about to run out of student part-time work, I think we're going to have something resembling a cost of living crisis, in other words, a surprise, in lots of university cities around the UK with not really much of a plan at any level to tackle it. So there you go. We will see. Great. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Kate Strudwick, Dean of Teaching and Learning at the University of Lincoln. I'm with Kelly Edmonds, Professor of Biology, Education and Student Experience at UEA. We have been blogging this week on Wonky about whether we have taken our eyes off the postgraduate student experience. In our paper, we explore the growing disconnect between institutional strategies and the lived experiences of postgraduate taught students. By reflecting on sector data, wider institutional observations and our own research, we discuss how to address the imbalance, arguing that while the undergraduate experience continues to dominate policy and practice, the unique needs of PGT students are often overlooked, despite their increase in numbers and strategic importance to the HE sector. We put out there a call for action for a more nuanced and intentional approach to supporting PG students, to develop and build a sense of belonging and offer practical reflections for institutional leaders, educators and policymakers.
Now, let's go back to international students then. It's this, Anton, this has been a summer of discussion really around immigration and asylum, and international students have been caught up in that debate this week.
Indeed, and it's been a real issue. I mean, obviously the Home Office is putting a lot of attention on how people coming to the UK on other visas, whether it's student visas or work visas, then transition to become to apply for asylum. And, you know, the latest yearly data, I think, showed about 13% of asylum claims, around 15,000, came from those who entered the UK on a study visa. Now, actually, yesterday, the Home Office published additional, you know, data on what they've been doing, and it actually suggests that they're beginning to get on top of this. So they've seen a reduction of that number. But again, as you say, this is all tied up with the immigration white paper, and it's perhaps presenting also quite an unhelpful face to the international students, because I mean we've just heard this week that they've been contacting by email and text all those on international student visas, basically to tell them don't overstay your time in the UK, and it, you know, it's again trying to strike the right balance, because clearly we don't want to see an abuse of the system, but at the same time not sounding too unwelcome at the time when, you know, many other countries around the world are actually welcoming more international students, and even in Australia where it looked as if they were going to move towards a very, you know, draconian regime of caps, actually it now looks as if all that is going to be a bit softer than it was announced.
Danny, this issue of international, or at least people on an international student visa claiming asylum, I mean, you know, there's a debate about the kind of contextualization of the numbers and the stat about whether you think it's, you know, high or not hugely high, but it's one of those numbers when you read it in the paper that feels high. Do we know why so many people on student visas are claiming asylum?
Well, I think that there'll be a whole range of reasons, and of course the one which government's most concerned about are those which they feel it is an abuse of the system, that potentially it's something that was mentioned by the Home Office, was agents or other bodies kind of irresponsibly advising students to claim asylum when it might not be appropriate. But there will also be loads of other students for whom they are, you know, rightfully claiming asylum and who need to access that kind of safe route. And I note that the MAC in their review of the graduate route did say coming to the UK legally on a work or study visa and then making a legitimate admissible asylum application does not constitute abuse. And I think this framing that all or the majority is kind of with nefarious intentions or is abusive is more about the current media commentary, more about the concern about the rise of reform than it is necessarily because we know that all of those represent an abuse of the system. And I think it's a really difficult framing to get because I guess from the government point of view, it doesn't really matter whether, you know, immigration is now polling as one of the biggest public concerns, or in many polls actually ahead of the NHS. And it's neither here nor there to the government, really, whether this is instigated by media commentary and reform versus a natural concern people would have had anyway. The fact is it's a big concern for people and it's causing unrest, it's causing discontent, and, you know, government's very aware of the risk they might face the next election. That said, pressure from other political groups, pressure from media commentary doesn't always make good policy. And so I think probably the biggest barrier for the Home Office here is trying to figure out, you know, what data do we have? What evidence do we have of abuse? Is it in certain pockets of the system? And therefore, how do we root that out and tackle it? I think there is a risk, though, in sensationalizing and kind of feeding some of those anti-immigration narratives, which can become quite hostile and polarised and very unwelcoming, both to potential students who might want to come and study in the UK, but also to people who already live in the UK who have experienced immigration or whom their family have experienced immigration. And I think it's a shame that these issues, which are primarily, you know, quite complex policy issues, become so polarised and can create such discontent if not handled very sensitively by government.
Jimbo, I guess, you know, one of the sort of, if we zoom out a little bit, one of the wider debates that's going on here is about the extent to which immigration in all of its forms around the UK represents economic migration rather than, in the case of, you know, refugees, you know, fleeing persecution or whatever. And it seems to me that to some extent, of course, at least rhetorically, the sector leans in to the idea that you can improve your life chances, you know, boost your, you know, employment chances and so on when recruiting students in general, but international students specifically. And then the message here seems to be, well, no, you shouldn't have been, and you should never have been, and you're not allowed to be an economic migrant. Is there a danger in a kind of rug pull here, at least rhetorically?
Do you remember when Reform won Runcorn last year, Jim? How long ago? I can't remember what the MP's name is now. Anyway, when Reform won Runcorn, Labour then rushed out a range of announcements about immigration and clamping down, or being really tough and all that sort of usual stuff. Runcorn doesn't have a university. It has a number of partnerships with higher education providers. It has some sort of provision there, but it does not have a university. And the idea that clamping down on student migration of any kind is going to win a single vote in any part of the country is nonsense. It is plainly not true. However, what I think we get wrong as a sector is we find it really hard to connect with people on an emotional level who have more conservative views than we tend to have. And I think we are really skilled at explaining the net benefits of student migration in economic terms. We can talk about GVA, we can talk about how it revitalises the high streets, centre of cities, sort of work does that really well yesterday. I think we are really, really poor at talking about how student migration changes identities of a place and how people feel about it, and having a sort of realistic conversation that we work on a social contract and that is part of it. I think the other thing that I sort of feel slightly saddened by is I've been talking to a lot of student leaders, other than similar like you, Jim, and I've asked a lot of international student leaders of, you know, do you have any friends who are home students? And I've asked home students, do you have any friends who are international students? And the amount that said no to me just makes me wonder, like, it's not any sort of depressing state of affairs on campus, but how can we possibly with a straight face say to people like, oh, you know, really invest in cohesion, when actually sometimes in our own universities that also isn't the case? I think we need to be much more sympathetic and sort of empathetic to views of people we may disagree with in a world where we just can't keep talking about the economy. It is so much deeper than that.
Anton, just on economic impact, you know, to some extent, one of my reflections actually over the summer has been that whilst the sector's actually quite good at explaining the economic impact of international students while they're here in terms of their spend, what the sector is either doesn't know or is kind of relatively scared of, I guess, is talking about the need for immigration given a declining birth rate and an aging population. You know, I was reading something last night that said if we just stopped all immigration tomorrow, we'd last about 3 months as a country in terms of, you know, the tax base and the labour market and so on. Why is no one in the UK able to have a sensible conversation about, you know, immigration and the population in the next decade or so?
That's a great point, Jim. And it's because of what Danny pointed out. It's become so politically fractious that people are just unwilling to listen to this. A bit as, you know, during the whole Brexit debate, people said, well, who cares about the economy? We want our country back, whatever that means. So, you know, the OBR, every time it publishes a forecast, will generally look at what the, you know, its assumptions about net migrations will do to the potential for the economy to grow. It's there. It's in broad daylight. Politicians can cite it or not cite it as they wish. But, you know, for me, absolutely, this is one of the key things. And it's always, I do genuinely worry about this. You know, the government has a growth mission. We recognize that unless we can reboot that growth, public services are in danger. And, you know, as you say, even the whole economy will be in danger. The support for, you know, our health services, our social care sector. And yet we're unwilling to look at this particular bit of the variable because it doesn't fit with the debate around immigration. And those, you know, we've talked about Reform, that, you know, the way they've managed to frame this is in a way that it's a genuine bad for the country, even though stopping it or at least slowing down net migration to the kind of levels that they want to see will have a huge economic impact. And we need to talk about it, I think.
I think as well, to be fair, I was listening to the leading podcast, not to plug other podcasts in our podcast, But Nicola Sturgeon, I think of sort of political leaders, and you see this in leaders in Scotland, think a bit more, making the positive case for immigration, particularly around saying, look, we have an aging population, we need, you know, Anton, as you described, these sort of labour market needs. The real challenge is there is not a pro-immigration right in politics anymore, even on an economic basis. There is not a populist pro-migration movement. So the debate is so skewed to anti-immigration, regardless of the economic cost.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And actually, if you go back to even to the United States, where, of course, these debates are also playing out, you had in the 1970s, people like Gary Becker at the University of Chicago, you're saying, you know, we need to bring in the most talented people into the country if we are to be successful. And you, as you say, that element of the centre-right has kind of fizzled away.
Although, ironically, there are aspects of it in the right in the US. You know, maybe we need our own Elon Musk.
Indeed.
I wouldn't go that far, Jim, for all kinds of reasons.
That element of Elon Musk, you don't have to buy the whole thing.
But I would also add on the number of international students then claiming asylum. I mean, I think surely this must be a symptom of the fact that we just have very few safe routes now to asylum in this country. And it's, you know, it's the same as the small boats crossing. If you're, so, you know, the world's getting increasingly or feels increasingly more dangerous, conflict is rising, there's new types of conflict and geopolitical issues arising over time. And if you are trying to access a safe country, but there are no safe routes, then you have got very few options. One of those may be getting a student visa. And so, you know, the symptom of not having safe routes puts pressure on the kind of genuine routes into the country and for people that don't have any other option. And I think that's a real pressure, is that subsequent policy decisions have made it increasingly difficult for people to come to the country legally. And if someone is facing persecution, facing that their life is threatened and they're desperate in that way, then I think it's perfectly understandable that they would seek to find other routes.
Tell you what though, Danny, right? I have spent on trains this week, actually. I will write this up at some point. I have spent some time on a number of message boards and translating YouTube videos, right? And one of the things I'm getting a clear sense of is that lots of people are invested in selling a dream about the UK. So there are agents, to some extent, universities will play along, you know, you can improve your prospects and so on and so on. So people get to the UK and then there's lots of discussion about how, you know, people feel that they were missold or that the rug has been pulled or that the dream has gone or that, you know, suddenly the government is increasing the salary threshold to get onto the skilled worker route. And then there's quite a bit of advertising, which effectively is saying, well, here I am, I can offer you an extension of the dream. So here's me, I'm a law firm, here's how you can apply for asylum, with no sense of the, you know, the actual stats on success. And you know, I wonder about the extent to which we're sort of complicit in attracting people to the UK on the basis that they'll be able to stay when they can't.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a real challenge. I mean, look, it's a very lucrative business in terms of getting, you know, international students over to the UK in terms of the vastness of the agent market. And where there's gaps in the system where, you know, there's a lack of safe route or it's very difficult to get into a country, you know, people will exploit that and they'll sell promises that they can't live up to. And when, you know, when Keir Starmer ran on the election pledge that they were going to beat the gangs, you know, that's not just in my mind about these kind of people who are irresponsibly putting people on small boats where they might face harm, but also people who are using agent routes to mislead people into this country or to promise them something which can't be delivered or isn't allowed. And I mean, we saw this during COVID too. I think that for me was where the issues of agents really came to the front, where you had international students arriving who had been told that there was no lockdown in the UK and that you could go out to bars and everything was open, and then they get here and everything's closed, you know. And of course, this is not going to be all agents, and there are agents who act with integrity and good agent systems. But I think we haven't really got to grips with how do we regulate these agents properly and ensure that they aren't selling a false dream. But universities, as you say, Jim, are also guilty of this themselves. I always read with interest where you're looking through the websites which talk about how much it costs to be a student in the UK. I mean, I just can't believe that is allowed to continue, that universities, you know, misrepresent that. either through kind of just laziness or overwork for not updating pages or whatever the motivation is. It shouldn't be acceptable that we're giving inaccurate information to any applicants, whether they're international or home students.
Anton, there was some, and just before we come off this, there was some rumour in the press this week that the government might tackle this MRes issue where for research for MRes students, the dependent ban isn't in place.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, as my institution hasn't tried to go down this route. I've been actually quite staggered about the fact that some providers have continued to market what are essentially taught masters on their MRes's to try and take advantage of the loophole. And so, frankly, you know, again, as other contributors have said, I don't think the sector helps itself sometimes. And I think this is one area where, frankly, if, you know, it should be the same rule for all master's students, not just for taught masters.
Now, finally this week, governance. Advance HE has published a note of its big conversation on governance. Danny, what does it say?
Yeah, so as you say, Jim, there's been a lot of chatter about governance in the sector this week. So this result of this big conversation, which was discussions with people across the sector about what they feel is working well in university governance and what they feel is working less well or needs to change, was published this week by Advance HE. The report recognises that governance has changed for the better in many cases over the last decade, particularly on diversifying boards and appraisal processes for those on boards. But there's huge disparity across the sector in terms of how effective governing boards are, and certainly more improvements to be made. And they've got a whole list, including around the extent to which boards are able to be agile in decision making, something which can be very difficult in academic institutions that are famously slow and sometimes inflexible. And also ensuring that boards have the expertise and confidence to question and stress test information they're given. And of course, this comes after the independent report about governance and management at the University of Dundee, which found major failings in governance that had allowed a huge financial crisis to emerge, you know, the 35 million black hole in their budget. So it's really positive that Advance HE are taking leadership on this. I think it would be a mistake to assume that there might not be a Dundee type situation waiting to be exposed in England. And that's certainly a possibility that will be concerning for DfE and for government.
Yes. Now, Jimbo, let's so I noticed that the CUC's code is under review. Advance HE has published its big conversation. This, I have to say, this does feel a little bit like Titanic deck chairs to me.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd go that far. Look, I think Jim, as you know, my first love is public administration and how it works. And there's a few bits around this, right? So we've gone through a period in higher education where expansion was the norm. You got to choose what to expand in, what new initiatives, what markets, what students, what programs, onwards and onwards. We are now going through a period of significant contraction, and it is inevitable that requires a different set of arrangements, different kinds of skills, different kinds of collaborations, different kinds of input. So for all there's quite a lot going on, I suppose I'm heartened to see that we are thinking about it deeply. I think the thing that I've always been maybe not concerned by but surprised by in universities is I don't always think there's an underpinning theory of governance. I'm yet to see the boards sit down and sort of really consider, okay, what is the appropriate distribution of powers? How does this link in to what we are trying to decide as a board? How do we think about risk in this kind of sort of new dispersed way? I think it is growing, but I suppose it just feels like such a massive paradigm shift that maybe the old structures we have won't work. And maybe that's what the CUC review will conclude, that basically what we have now just can't be appropriate and is structurally ineffective, not just that we're not doing what we have now very well.
Bet you 50 quid it doesn't. Anton, I mean, interestingly, of course, in Scotland, there was, you know, of sorts, at least in the legislation around a decade ago, a review of the governance of higher education institutions.
Yeah, and of course it was a complete compromise around, you know, with different interest groups pushing for different structures, and the whole thing in the end was focused on how many governors of different constituencies do you have there. How do you elect the chair of the governing body? And frankly, you know, the one thing, if you read the Gillis review and then, of course, you look at the Advance HE, the contribution from Advance HE, there's only so much that structures in who, you know, who's represented on the governing body will address the problem. A lot of this is not about structures, about culture, actually. And, you know, if you look at the Dundee issue, or indeed the issue in other institutions that have suddenly swung from surplus into deficit, it's about basic things like financial controls. Do you have a proper financial framework in the university? Answer, no. You know, do you have management accounts coming regularly to senior management and to court through the finance committee? You don't. Well, you know, this is not rocket science. This is not about some complex, you know, governance structure. It's about the basics.
Danny, I've just done a day at student governance training, and, you know, I am the first to actually, you know, I think I'm on slide two of my presentation. It says, you know, think more about culture than structure. But it also does strike me that whether you're a student governor or whether you're a lay governor or a staff governor, there's a hell of a lot these days to get your head around. And one of my sort of, you know, things that I muse on the trainees, whether this kind of slow transfer of responsibilities and duties and to some extent powers to public authorities in general and universities specifically is compatible with the sort of governance that we have. Are we just expecting, you know, whether it's a great structure or culture, are we just expecting governing bodies to kind of understand and know and do too much? Have we abrogated responsibility from the state too much to the sector, do you think?
Well, I think there's a few issues there. I think something you're alluding to is kind of the burden on universities to be doing so many different things, to be regulated on different things, to have various different responsibilities, which is definitely a narrative that's very common in the sector. I mean, I'd say universities are not heavily regulated compared to other sectors. You know, there's an argument about, you know, whether it's too heavily regulated for what a university should be, but, you know, certainly compared to banking, finance and so on, it's not even close. I do think that, you know, for boards which, you know, traditionally, this is, you know, these are unpaid roles, people who are passionate about supporting education, there is a question about how do we ensure that the people who are sitting on boards are not only passionate and doing it out of kind of the goodness of their heart, but are also trained, experienced, knowledgeable, and maybe even compensated. And this featured in the report about whether there should be some type of compensation for board members to encourage that kind of depth of engagement in these complex topics. You know, on a board, you've got so many really complex legal duties, financial duties, and it's important that you have that breadth of expertise. But then the other piece, of course, is that even if you have, you know, excellent expertise on your board, if people don't feel that they can raise concerns or to express and share that knowledge, well, it's all wasted anyway. So I think you have to do them hand in hand. You have to make sure that you've got the right expertise, the right people on your board, and then you've got to make sure that they feel that they can speak out, that they can challenge this kind of, like, you know, healthy debate, and that that's, you know, deliberately encouraging. And similarly for student representatives as well, that they are empowered and knowledgeable and confident enough to make a contribution to that board.
Hmm. Jimbo, ever since the sort of mid-80s, the sort of orthodoxy from the Jarrett Report onwards has been, don't leave it to the amateurs, get some skilled externals in who sort of know what they're doing, and you know, make it smaller and more nimble. But one of my reflections a couple of months ago was, they did almost the diametric opposite in the Netherlands to tackle some, you know, vaguely similar issues, which was to increase the amount of internal scrutiny from both students and staff, because they would be able to spot some things that externals wouldn't. Are we stuck in a sort of 80s orthodoxy around, you know, improve the skills, improve the expertise and so on? You know, can we imagine other models?
Well, look, I don't think it's a bad thing to be continually look to improve skills, scrutiny, cultures on the board. Like, of course, we should do all of those things. I suppose one of the things that's striking is that most universities across the UK, you know, there's different mechanisms of appointments, different compositions, but broadly have a thing at the top, which is the university council, broadly have a finance one, broadly has a HR sort of one in terms of their subcommittees, and then off they go. You don't see lots of kinds of innovation around those spaces in terms of different kinds of subcommittees, different structures, how decisions are made, like, you know, having meeting formats which aren't just sort of receiving papers, going through them, etc. So I suppose I'd be up for a model of governance innovation, but ultimately there is a very sort of, prescriptive is the wrong word, but I suppose a relatively tight set of legal duties that inevitably under similar structures. So, you know, maybe I'm not hugely optimistic about the way the university sector is governed, but I think there is lots of improvement to be made within the structures we have, rather than sort of throwing everything out entirely.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Anton, Danny, Jimbo, Michael Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.